Lecture 21, Sartre on Bad Faith.
Sartre's subtitles being In Nothingness, an essay in phenomenological ontology. That's a phrase he borrowed directly from Heidegger, indicating two things. First, that it's phenomenological, which in Sartre has a very precise meaning. The idea of phenomenology is it's all from the first-person standpoint. And Sartre, unlike Heidegger, has no hesitation, saying an examination of consciousness, or properly speaking, the objects of consciousness. On the other hand, it's an ontology. Like Heidegger, he wants to insist that when we examine what we experience, although Heidegger wouldn't use that term, we are describing the things of this world. But of course, a Nietzschean twist, when we describe the things of this world from the first person, we are quite clearly describing them always from a perspective. And in fact, it's a very particular and sometimes peculiar perspective. Most notably, when we describe things from the first person perspective, what we're doing is coming up with conclusions that are very often going to be at odds with science and objective thinking. As I stressed in the last lecture, it's not as if Sartre rejects science any more than Kierkegaard does. But he too would probably say something like, all power to the sciences, but, and then go on to say, here's what's really important, our understanding of ourselves, and that has to be through the eyes of phenomenology. Sartre introduces an ontology, but one has to be very careful here. He uses the word being, but I think this is in many ways a kind of copycat behavior, because Heidegger was in many ways his model. And since he thought of himself as doing ontology, it seemed to follow that being was the subject matter. Nevertheless, I think we wouldn't go wrong in not taking very seriously what Sartre calls being, and instead talking about that too in terms of perspectives and aspects. He distinguishes, as I indicated in an earlier lecture, primarily between consciousness on the one hand and the world on the other. The first he refers to as being for itself. And the essential idea here is that when we reflect, we necessarily recognize that we are conscious. Descartes makes this quite explicit in his much quoted statement, I think, therefore I am. But for Sartre, it's not necessarily reflection that does this. There's a sense in which consciousness is always aware of itself, or more properly speaking, aware of itself, aware of objects, all the time. And it's not something which is prone just to reflective recognition. On the side of the world, what Sartre says is, here we find being in itself. The notion of in itself, of course, has a long philosophical tradition. Kant had talked about the world in itself. Many philosophers following, Nietzsche, for example, attacked the world, the idea of the world in itself. But the idea of being in itself seemed to capture for Sartre the idea of simple physical existence. And he really doesn't worry much about the kinds of questions, say, that bothered Husserl about the being of, say, numbers or the being of abstract entities. One should add here, for completeness, that Sartre adds a third category. So it's not going to be simply on one hand, on the other hand, but it's going to be, in rather dramatic form, a kind of trio of concepts. And that third concept, which I've very scantily alluded to in the last lecture, is what he calls being for others. And the example that I gave, which might be a good example for that, is the example of shame or embarrassment. But since he doesn't introduce that until a good 300 pages into his book, I'm going to stick for the time being just with the categories of being for itself and being in itself and how they relate to each other. In an essay which he wrote just prior to Being in Nothingness, called The Transcendence of the Ego, Sartre argues what will turn out to be an extremely important thesis for him. It makes a distinction, which Descartes, for example, did not make, which Husserl did not make, between the self, or ego, on the one hand, and consciousness on the other. About the self, Sartre says, it is out there in the world like the self of another. In other words, we talk about ourselves in philosophy all too often as if it's something deep down inside, the true self. And of course, there's a long Christian tradition which takes the self as the soul. What Sartre wants to say is the self is something very different than that. The self is an accumulation of actions and experiences. It is who I am, in a way, that is determined by the world, that is determined by my activities in the world. It is an accumulation of all of my achievements and failures in such a way that the way I describe myself as a self is no different from the way someone else would describe me as a self. In fact, as we all know to our embarrassment, it is sometimes the case that other people know ourselves better than we know ourselves. There's a sense in which we can tell that someone is arrogant when he or she can't tell himself, herself, that he's arrogant, she's arrogant. There's a sense in which the self, then, is not something to be found directly in phenomenology, and certainly in no sense inside of consciousness or equivalent to consciousness, as Husserl suggested. But to find out who you are, you have to really review the tapes and videos of your life. You have to look back to see what you've done. And very often, that picture will be very different from your perception of yourself simply from a momentary bit of introspection. Consciousness, on the other hand, as I talked in some detail in the last lecture, consciousness is nothing but an activity. It is an activity directed towards the world and its objects. It is an activity which is not just passive in the sense of receiving information, but very active, not just in terms of understanding, but in terms of transforming the world according to our desires, according to our expectations, according to our ideals. Furthermore, as we saw in our discussion of the emotions, Sartre also wants to distinguish between self-consciousness in its reflective mode and self-consciousness, or simply consciousness, as pre-reflective. I should say, in Sartre's text, this gets enormously complicated, partly because of the fundamental idea of being for itself, which seems to presuppose some sense of self-awareness even on the pre-reflective level. But I'm not going to try and sort out those paradoxes here. What's important for our purposes is really to say that when we understand consciousness, in Sartre we should not think necessarily in terms of reflective consciousness, but often it's consciousness without being, in some reflective sense, aware of itself. Let me give an example, and it's Sartre's example. Suppose I am trying to catch a streetcar, or to get away from old technology, suppose I'm trying to catch a bus. If I were to describe my experience at that time, as a phenomenologist would, it would not be, here I am trying to catch a bus. It would be something more like, bus to be caught up with. There goes the bus. The number of feet between where I am and the bus. My perceptions, my consciousness, would wholly be caught up in the need to catch the streetcar. But the I, Sartre says, the I doesn't yet appear. When the I does appear, it is not necessarily as an agent, but sometimes, as Heidegger had pointed out, it's simply a kind of formal indicator of the person who's doing the talking, the describing, the thinking. But the important point here is that consciousness itself in no sense contains the I, in no sense contains the self. And our experience has to be understood in terms of, as Heidegger put it, tasks to be completed, people in the world to be appealed to, a sense of things to be done. What counts as the self, on the other hand, is going to be the sort of thing that we find in a biography. An autobiography is really just one instance of biography. We should not assume that we are in a better position to know who we are and what our life looks like than anybody else. So, human existence is a curiosity. It's a curiosity in that we are not simply consciousness, and sometimes Descartes talks that way, but of course we are all people, and people have bodies. People perform actions with their bodies. People are subject to the material cause and effect relationships in the world, which is a way of saying, in Sartre's jargon, that we are both being in itself and being for itself. That there's a sense in which we are not simply bodies, not simply creatures. And Sartre, by the way, would abstain from questions about where consciousness enters into the evolutionary chain as being irrelevant. Like Heidegger, he starts with the phenomenological fact of my own existence in the world, and the question is wholly, How, then, must I see myself? What are the essential structures of that consciousness? As Husserl tried to pursue the question. Because I'm both being in itself and being for itself, because I'm both a body and a mind, I have two different sets of attributes. On one hand, what I have is what Heidegger had called, and what we will call, following Sartre, facticity. Facticity should be construed as simply the sum total of facts that are true about us. Examples of my facticity: the fact that I was born on a certain date in a certain year, the fact that I am now a certain height, the fact that I am living in the 20th century, the fact that I am born of the parents who are my parents, the fact that I was raised as I was raised, the fact that I went to school and got degrees and learned such and such, that's all part of my facticity. My medical health is part of my facticity. My situation in general is part of my facticity. The fact that I am now standing in Virginia, part of my facticity. In short, you might say, everything that is factual about us is constitutive of my facticity. And one can understand this in terms of, for example, my past, the idea that everything that's past, in a sense, is now a fact, and I can't alter it. The fact that everything about me presently, in some sense, is now a fact, and I can't alter it. And there may be facts about the future, too. For example, Heidegger pointed out one rather notorious and problematic fact, and that is the fact that we are all going to die. That might not be a fact in the sense of having already happened, so I can't say when it is, but we all understand exactly what it means to say it is a fact that I'm going to die. Contrasted with facticity is that aspect of ourselves which Sartre calls transcendence. Now, transcendence is a rather unfortunate term here because it has such a rich philosophical history, particularly in the German philosophy that Sartre is in many ways following. Transcendence sometimes means outside of the world, or other times it means outside of experience. In the first instance, for instance, God is often referred to as transcendent, outside of the world. In the second instance, people like Kant would talk about the world as it is in itself, as being transcendent in the sense of being outside of our experience. Sartre doesn't have either of these meanings in mind, and it's problematic that he uses a term which is, as I say, so rich in philosophical history. But I think we can talk about transcendence in Sartre in two ways, and they're both rather concrete. First, my transcendence is the sense in which I overreach the facts about my life. So, for example, I have aspirations, plans, and desires that reach beyond the facts of my life and the facts of the matter, and they're possibilities. They are not yet facts, and I can choose between them. And as you can guess, transcendence is going to be absolutely essential to Sartre's notion of freedom. Not only do we transcend the facts, but we also transcend the present. This is again a Heideggerian point, the idea that time is not simply the specious present, the momentary present, that line between the past and the future, but time, my time, described from the first person, is already full of the past and is already pregnant with the future. So I transcend the present into the future all the time. I am always seeing the world in terms of my expectations, my hopes, my plans, my fears, and so on. In a sense, to say that I'm transcendence is to say that I am not what I am. And Sartre puts in as one of his more frequent little paradoxes that the very nature of being for itself, and consequently the hallmark of transcendence, is the fact that I am what I am not, and I am not what I am. It sounds straightforwardly paradoxical, but I think we can now understand it quite clearly. What I aspire to be is, let's say, a lawyer. I am not now a lawyer. Nevertheless, my plan, my aspiration, is to be defined in terms of becoming a lawyer. And my activities from now until then can be understood only in terms of that plan. Am I a lawyer now? No. But to describe me, you would have to say what I am not yet. The sense is that we are always to be described in terms of our possibilities, and our plans. And again, to go back to a point I made very early in the Sartre lectures, this is not necessarily something that I am fully conscious of in the sense of being reflectively articulate about it. Sometimes my possibilities are there, and I deny them, or I ignore them, or I'm simply unaware of them. Nevertheless, what I want to be determines what I am in a very obvious and profound way. But this distinction between facticity and transcendence, the idea of, on the one hand, being what the facts about me say I am, and on the other hand, being what I am not yet, namely, what I plan to be or hope to be, these two don't fit together very conveniently. And let me point out two problems that Sartre points out in great detail. The first is that what we all want, in a strictly neurotic sense, is to be both pure facticity and pure transcendence. Sartre sums this up by the conscientiously blasphemous comment that what we really desire is to be God. Going back to some medieval characterizations of God, what we find is that God is described as, first of all, complete in himself. And one might say, everything that God can be, he is. And at the same time, because God is all-powerful, one wants to say that God can do anything he wants. But now think about the way we think about our lives. There's a sense in which we talk with some compulsiveness about getting ourselves together and defining ourselves, determining exactly who we are, and knowing with some certainty what is ourself. At the same time, we have what philosophers often refer to as this desire for negative freedom, to be free from constraints, to be able to do anything we choose to do. But when you put these two together, you get a kind of contradiction. And of course, Sartre doesn't mind the conclusion that the very notion of God is therefore a contradiction. The other problem is much more far-reaching and will give rise to the rest of this lecture. And that is, I just described facticity and transcendence in a pretty straightforward way. Namely, facticity is everything that's now true of us, and transcendence is just that which is not true of us, or at least not true yet. But take some of the examples I cited. For example, my birthday. That would seem to be a fact written somewhere in the annals of the universe. But nevertheless, when I look at it from the first-person point of view, it is not simply a fact at all. For instance, I might look at my birthday as being too early. I'd rather be younger. Or many of my undergraduates who are only 19 or 20 look at their birthday and they think, it's too late. And what's more, they take active steps to change it. They find false ID cards. They lie about their age. And although they might change their minds about which direction the lie should go in subsequent years, there's a sense in which they are not accepting this fact about themselves, but rather trying to replace it with a different fact. And one can, of course, get very complicated here and say, suppose one of my students not only gets a false ID, but actually goes back to the hospital in which he was born and goes to the records in the halls of records where he was born and actually changes the date on the significant documents. Would that change the birth date? Well, the metaphysical view, the third-person view we might have of this, is of course not. What he's doing is lying about the date, but the date, no matter what he does, remains the same. But the truth is, that in a very important sense, how the date plays in his life is subject to his transcendence, to his expectations, his hopes, his plans, and so on. So too, we talk about transcendence as our possibilities. But what our possibilities are must be understood in terms of what the facts are. I can't simply want to be an angel. I can't simply want to be, at my age, a great basketball player. I'm too short and I'm too old. There's a sense in which when we start talking about possibilities, even though in one sense we are absolutely free to imagine almost anything we want, we are in fact quite limited in the choices we have. So facticity starts to look as if it's going to be corrupted and compromised by transcendence. And transcendence looks as if it's going to be constricted by facticity. But it gets worse. Sartre introduces a concept which has become quite famous. It's the concept of mauvaise foi, bad faith. It is something like self-deception, but much more particularly, it is self-deception about oneself, about who one is. And we can see from what I've already said the form in which this will probably appear. I can lie to myself about who I am by claiming to be just facticity. In other words, myself is defined by simply what facts are true of me. Not only myself will be so defined, but I will go into bad faith by pretending that my consciousness is so defined too. So I can say that I am a certain age, that's a fact about me, and that defines what I can do. So I don't plan to be a basketball player. I refuse to even consider the possibility. Or one can lie to oneself about the facts in a different way by ignoring them. One can simply live through wishful thinking, through one's hopes, or perhaps one's fears, and in so doing, deny the facts that are true of oneself. Because the difficult thesis is that we are necessarily both of these, and both of them in a kind of tension which ultimately is going to characterize Sartre's view of human nature. Let me go through several of his examples. Most famously, since Sartre wrote in Parisian cafes, and one can see him there scribbling his 20 pages a day, one can imagine him sort of watching the people that are walking around him, and in particular here's the waiter who is serving him. And he sees the waiter behaving rather oddly, in a sense. He walks kind of like a military man, makes very sharp military corners. He's very stiff, and if you've been in a Parisian cafe, you know the picture. He is acting out a role, Sartre says. And the question is, what's the role? And Sartre tells us he is trying to be a waiter. In other words, he is acting as if he is nothing but a waiter. Let's take a more dramatic example. A Nazi soldier is given an awful assignment. Let's just say, as an example that Camus uses, he is asked to shoot a couple of children. Well, challenged on the awfulness of his behavior, the Nazi officer might well say, "Look, I'm just following orders. In other words, I am a Nazi soldier, and I cannot do otherwise." But of course, we can very quickly point out that he can do otherwise. The cost of doing otherwise may in fact be lethal. He could be court-martialed, he could be shot on the spot, but nevertheless, what he is, in a sense, is negotiable. This notion of confusing one's facticity, what is now true of one, as in a way one's essence, what one must be, is the most obvious form of bad faith and the one that Sartre plays with through a great deal of his philosophy. Because the truth is that our freedom, our transcendence, always makes the facts about us in play and makes it possible for any fact about us, no matter how critical and unavoidable, any fact can nevertheless be dealt with in a number of different ways. Sartre gives the example of a young woman on a date. Now, I would argue that there are several confusions embedded in this example, so I want to spend a fairly short time on it for now. But the young woman on her first date is talking fairly high intellectual matters, let's say discussing Heidegger with her companion. And she is acting as if she is just this intellect, this brilliant and witty mind, when in the middle of the date, the young man reaches across the table, puts his hand on her, and rather tenderly caresses her as he's talking. The young woman, at this point, doesn't want to get involved. She is rather enjoying her intellectual existence. And so what Sartre says, and I think one can argue this is a very sexist interpretation, what Sartre says is that she denies what is in fact happening to her. She, as he puts it, disowns her hand, just kind of leaves it limp under her companion's, and instead goes on as if she is nothing but this intellectual mind. Now, I think there are a number of problems. For one thing, how does Sartre know, doing his phenomenology, what this young woman is thinking? And secondly, if you imagine being a young woman on a date with an unwanted advance, One might say what she does is exactly the right strategy. Nevertheless, the idea is that the young woman is in bad faith because in this case, she is disowning an obvious fact about her situation. Third example that Sartre gives has to do with a frigid wife. And Sartre points out that during sex, she finds herself thinking about her household accounts. Well, what Sartre says rather bluntly to the psychoanalysts who had talked about such examples is that thinking about the household accounts is a choice, and it is the way that one makes oneself frigid. It is not a psychodynamic beyond one's control, but quite to the contrary, it is a choice not to get involved. The best example, perhaps, is the example of the hesitant homosexual, someone who in fact has had a good many homosexual encounters, who finds in himself homosexual desires, and nevertheless resists being called a homosexual. Sartre, in fact, provides us with an example of just this sort in an early novel he writes called The Age of Reason. The homosexual's problem is that looking at the facts of the matter, the number of encounters he has already had, the way he finds his desires oriented, one has to say, as what Sartre calls the champion of sincerity would insist on saying, I am a homosexual. But of course, to say I am a homosexual is to define myself as essentially a certain kind of being, whereas the truth is, I still have choices. One of the best-known gay intellectuals of our time, Gore Vidal, has often said, there is no such thing as homosexuality and there are no homosexuals. They're only homosexual acts. And I think that's very much in a Sartrean line. The idea is that to say I am a homosexual is to turn myself into just my facticity. On the other hand, to pretend that I haven't done what I've done, to pretend that I don't have the desires that I have, is bad faith of a different sort. In all these examples, Sartre takes on Freud, because what Freud says is essentially, there's a psychodynamic here, that there's a sense in which we cannot do certain things, we cannot take certain positions. And what Sartre wants to say in every case is, we will not, we refuse to take certain positions, or we choose to look at ourselves in one way rather than another way. So the idea is that when we are in bad faith, what we are doing is we are misperceiving, misjudging ourselves. And as we noticed in the essay on emotions, this is something we do for a purpose. And often the purpose is pretty straightforward. One doesn't want to take responsibility. When one emphasizes facticity, one is full of excuses. The facts of the matter, one's age, the circumstances, one's upbringing, one's parents, anything which is a fact somehow can be used to wriggle out of our claim to responsibility. On the other hand, to think of ourselves as pure transcendence, as Sartre gives in the rather curious example of joy and also falling in love in the essay on emotions, what we notice is that a person chooses a kind of irresponsibility too, because by just focusing on the possibilities, on the fantasies, what one does is one doesn't pay attention to the actual facts of the matter. There's a sense in Sartre, which comes through fairly clearly in his discussion of the homosexual's dilemma, in which we're kind of damned if we do and damned if we don't, that we're always prone to emphasize either our facticity or our transcendence. And if that's so, we are bound to bad faith. And Sartre, in fact, does sometimes give us the suggestion that bad faith is something that we cannot escape, that we are creatures who are, by our very construction, as being in itself, being for itself, are caught in the necessity of bad faith. This raises some serious questions about what should count as ethics for Sartre. And perversely, Sartre, like Heidegger, says he is not doing ethics. But nevertheless, I think there is no question whatever that any reader can raise that that's exactly what he's doing, ethics. If we can't escape bad faith, that makes it sound as if bad faith is just an excuse in itself. But there's no doubt, as he goes through his examples and his many plays and novels, that bad faith is something that admits of all sorts of variations and degrees. And there's no question that bad faith is bad. It is something to be avoided. I want to suggest that what Sartre does is he doesn't reject or neglect ethics or morality. What he does is he rather takes on a different kind of view of these matters. And to use a simple word to put a label on it, we can say what Sartre is really after is a theory of integrity.